It was a preliminary hearing. As he worked on May's case, Berry was fast coming to appreciate the sheer canniness of the radium firm in settling the year before. The second time around, it was even harder for him to build a case. The drinkers, Kerr and Martland all refused to testify, and there were no champions in the press hounding the firm into submission. The five girls were helping May by waiving their right to patient confidentiality. They wanted the committee of doctors to use their cases to prove that radium poisoning existed. But not only did Markley object to any reference to the five girls, both their medical diagnoses and even the fact of last year's settlement, by saying that they were in no way connected to this case, the company appointed doctors also declined to give evidence. Yet as Catherine had once written, it would be difficult to find another like Raymond Berry. He summoned Craver and Ewing to the hearing regardless. They were furious. Even though Ewing witnessed the women swearing under oath that they were happy for him to discuss their cases, he refused on the grounds of patient confidentiality. Dr. Crumba, the girl's ally on the board, was happy to give evidence. And even though Markley threatened to sue him if he did, Berry persuaded the doctor to continue. The lawyer's skill, both in handling witnesses and in presenting his case, was growing. He now had all the data and experience to make life very difficult indeed for the United States Radium Corporation. He was a most uncomfortable thorn in its side. The executives had assumed that when they settled the first five cases, Berry would be off their backs. They now realised they had been very much mistaken. Black Tuesday, they called it. 29th of October 1929, the day a financial nightmare rocked Wall Street and paper fortunes melted away like frost under a hot sun. Wall Street, wrote one witness to the crash that day, was a street of vanished hopes, of curiously silent apprehension, and of a sort of paralysed hypnosis. More than 100 blocks north of where America's economy was imploding, Quinta McDonald lay in her room at the New York Memorial Hospital. Here, too, was silent apprehension and paralysis, but never, Quinta promised herself, never would her hope be gone. She had been admitted in September, in a dying condition, but a month on she was still fighting, and how. It was incredible for her friends and family to witness. She was a Spartan, said her sister-in-law Ethel, who was caring for the McDonald children while their mother was in hospital. She always said, pretty good, when I asked her how she was. Never did she think she was going to die. Her one thought was to live for the children, commented Quinta's husband, James. The thought of them lent her courage to fight for her life. The McDonalds were now reconciled, yet the past year had been turbulent. Although James had been awarded $400 in the 1928 settlement, that sum was dwarfed by his wife's new wealth, and it seems the difference had rankled. Then unemployed, James had spent his money in speakeasies over the summer, while Quinta had invested hers in a trust fund for the children. One night, in September 1928, his resentment had come to a head. When Quinta refused his demands for money, James had viciously struck his crippled wife and threatened to gas her to death, turning on every gas jet in the house as she lay helpless in her plaster casts. He was arrested. Quinta, however, did not press charges. It was not the first time she'd been hit. She did begin divorce proceedings with Berry's help, but it seems James later won her round and they were eventually dropped.